Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This season of Strong Opinions Loosely Held is brought to you by ESPN. Saturdays are for college football, apparently, and Saturday, December 29th is the Saturday of all Saturdays. It's the college football playoff. Who's playing? Great question. It's Alabama versus Oklahoma and Notre Dame versus Clemson. Those are all colleges, by the way, and they've got really good football teams. And they'll all be competing for the national championship. It's on ESPN, and it's streaming live on the ESPN app. Watch it. But only after you've listened to this season of Strong Opinions Loosely Held. Believe me, it'll be a whole new experience. Welcome to Season 4 of Strong Opinions Loosely Held. I'm Elisa Kreisinger, and we are devoting all 5 episodes this season to women in sports. Why? Well, because it has been a huge year for female athletes both on and off the courts. From Serena's quote-unquote outburst on the court during the U.S. Open.
You owe me an apology. I have never cheated in my life. I have a daughter and I stand what's right for her. I've never cheated. And you owe me an apology.
To U.S. women's hockey getting a livable wage and benefits similar to the men's team.
We got, you know, what we thought was fair and what they were providing for the men. And so we're really, really proud of that. And we're really, you know, happy with the agreement that we came to with USA Hockey.
And of course, USA Gymnastics' culture of abuse was finally exposed.
You are the USA Gymnastics National Team Doctor and the United States Olympic Team Doctor. You were trusted by so many and took advantage of countless athletes and their families.
This season, I'm talking to athletes, fans, and critics to explore how women use sports to find themselves, advocate for each other, and play with our cultural concepts of race and gender. Our first episode, we're devoting to college football. Why? Well, there's a lot to unravel there. College football has everything. Devoted female fans, camaraderie, game day rituals, but the players aren't paid, the coaches are making millions, and there's this pattern of disregard for sexual assault allegations that we'll get into. A 2013 Ohio University study found that 50% of women identified as football fans, and 57% of college women attended 3 or more football games. So, what is it about college football that women identify with? And how are they negotiating all of this while still remaining a fan? I talked to 3 fans of college football to find out. The first is Annie Taylor.
Some of my earliest memories of going to any sort of organized football event is the University of Virginia football games. I was a Division I lacrosse player for the University of Virginia. At the time when I was recruited, we were a top 5 program. I know what it's like to play a sport at the very highest level that you can play it.
She's a fan of college football, even though when she was in college, her own lacrosse team was much better than the football team.
We were really bad at football, but there was all this ritual around game day. There's tailgating and there's getting dressed up. There was something about that being a specific cultural aspect that was fun to be a part of.
Was there a ritual around supporting the women's lacrosse team? Not really. More on that this season. But first, Megan Doyle. She's also a college football fan. She got into it because it allowed her to form a bond with her father.
I think that when I grew up, I started realizing, you know, the dynamics of fathers and daughters. And to this day, my father will call me, text me. We have this bond that is so deep. And sure, it's something that, like, he loves dearly, but he taught me to love it too. And so it's kind of this connector that no matter what, we're very different people. We have this common ground.
It started as a connection with her dad that blossomed into a way for her to connect with her entire family.
Again, it just kind of became something that I was able to connect with them on.
At my school, I love my friends and that camaraderie almost more than I love the game. I love that the game is what brings us together.
That's my friend and colleague, Crystal Champagne. She loves football, and it's even helped her with her career.
Even at work, it was easy for me to bridge the gap between my male bosses. It was kind of an easy way to kind of build a friendship with talking about sports. And it just so happened that my 2 male direct report, or that I report into, they have similar team love. So it really has helped in the work environment. And so it helps get me in conversations that I normally wouldn't be a part of because of my love of sports.
All right, so at this point, I'm kind of wondering how much further could I be in my career if I was a fan of college football?
I think being a football fan and being a sports fan and playing sports is inherently feminist in a way.
That's Annie again.
I wanted to be part of the boys growing up. I remember being in middle school basketball and I was too good for the girls' side that they asked if I wanted to play with the boys, and I felt like that was no higher honor. But I felt like I was always trying to be equal amongst the best. So now that I rose the ladder of my own athletic ability and I invested so much of my life and so much of my identity as being an athlete, I want to surround myself with people that also understand that point of view. And often that's men. That it has definitely been a way for me to make friends and make valuable connections in my adulthood, right? Because it's me expressing myself.
I think if anything, to be honest, you know, I was raised a tomboy. I was a tomboy. I loved sports. It was something that made me feel really empowered as a young girl. I think some of that, and even the way that I can talk to men, I do think that some of that comes from sports, but I think it's in a way that like I feel very empowered by it. It's very well documented on the ESPN 30 for 30, the U. Growing up in Miami in the 80s and 90s, it was a mishmash of cultures, you know, especially between the Cuban culture, the African-American culture, the, you know, white culture. I just think that there was something there in Miami, and I grew up with this as a little girl, knowing that everyone in the stadium was not a college person because our stadium was in the middle of the city. You know, you didn't have to speak English. You didn't have to look like everyone else to be a huge fan. And hugging those people and high-fiving those people, it was just such a community that, like, didn't see race, didn't see color, didn't see any of that.
The female fans I spoke with made sure to note the distinction between college football and the NFL. See, college football is seen as more pure because the players aren't getting paid and they're amateurs.
And I think a lot of people are trying to make the distinction between NFL and college football. College football, I mean, I do think it's a more pure game. A very slim percentage actually goes to the pros. So you are watching younger kids who are playing probably for their last time at a really high level just because they love playing the game.
What is it about college football that young women find really approachable and interesting to make them fans of it?
Looking back now, I think humans always want to try to like fit in, and it is a way to be a part of a group. I think, again, that's kind of the underlying thing that brings people so close together. And I think in this world, we always are looking at what keeps people different or what sets us apart or how we're different or standing out from the crowd. And I think that sometimes people just want to be a part of the crowd and be a part of normalcy. Don't we all just want to find some sort of community and partnership and pairing off? There's this weird thing where it does bring that together. I don't know. Maybe that's a little too much, but it's definitely deep thoughts that happen in Megan's brain when sitting at a football game.
I don't know what it is about these kids, but they are just having fun out there, like on the field. It's not the same thing as when you're watching a professional game. They just don't have that same pressure maybe involved. It's more for fun. It's more because you just want to win for your team, for your school. It's not like there's this Super Bowl on the line or there's millions of dollars. At least for the kids, they're just doing it for the love of the game. So I think it makes it easier to watch.
But Crystal also struggles with being a fan.
I'm black. If they didn't know. Whew. Being black and loving sports is hard. Being black and a woman, harder. I think it's tough. There's the one side where I'm so happy to see these young black men thriving, doing so well. But that's when I also am very upset when they're not getting paid. And I'm not saying that every black kid on all of these teams is some kid who doesn't have money and comes from some unfortunate background. But there are some who you've recruited from some small town down south who hasn't been exposed to a lot. You bring them out here, you parade them around, you've got your booster clubs and all this stuff, and this kid sees none of the benefits from that. And then he can have a life-threatening injury on the field and never recover from that, and his family was expecting him to go on to the league from there. So it's tough in that regard. I think sometimes I see these students being used as, like, they're seen as the face of these franchises, but they don't really get that same recognition. But I do think that race plays such an important factor in all aspects of life, but in the sports realm where you're supposed to just be rewarded for being a great athlete, race plays a factor that sometimes people who should be celebrated more or recognized more are diminished because of the color of their skin. There are a lot of things that make being a sports fan complicated. When it comes to college football, well, I'll say it, you do what you want with it. Mm-hmm. I think that some of the things like Penn State, I have a hard time watching those games because I think for so long they ignored stuff that happened to children. And I personally can't get past that. I don't think that this sport is more important than children's lives and what happened to them. So I don't watch any of their games. I will boycott them as long as I can. But I'm just saying, like, it's a daily struggle to be a sports fan. To be a woman and to be a sports fan is really tough. And I think you have to, like, kind of pick and choose what you engage in or how far you go with it and then separate it. So I think it is tough sometimes to be a woman who likes sports, just any sport in general.
Annie also shared a similar struggle with being a fan of men's sports, but her struggle was from a different, more personal perspective.
I should have more guilt about being a woman who is a big fan of men's sports, given my experience.
During her sophomore year at the University of Virginia, Annie's teammate and good friend was killed by her boyfriend, who also happened to play on the men's lacrosse team.
I've been a part of that statistic, not personally, but through someone that I know very well.
And the statistic being?
Statistic being that maybe men's sports has some sort of correlation to domestic abuse. I had a lot of anger towards the men's team, a lot, because I thought, how could you not hold him accountable to some of his actions that were red flags in the past? And I think men need to be better about holding their friends accountable, and boys will be boys doesn't cut it at all. And that was what had excused a lot of behavior that were hindsight red flags. And we also have to be better as women understanding what abusive relationships look like and holding everyone accountable to that. And I think hindsight, we also have a lot more awareness to what that looks like. And I think that's just another lens of how I look at sports. And I've constantly reconciled my experience on my team and losing a friend of mine and still being a fan of sports and competition.
What would it take for you to be a bigger fan of women's sports?
We need more exposure.
I think that sometimes if the women's sports were hyped up, you'd find them more. On Sunday or Saturday, I can see like 10 of my channels like have a college football game, so I can literally just click through all of them and see what's on. I don't think that same accessibility is there for top-notch women's sports.
So we're starting the season looking at college football, and that's because, yes, so many women are fans of it, but also because it brings up so many questions that we're grappling with as a society and a culture.
I mean, I think college football is a good place to start because it is so popular and there's so much about it that you can pull from and you can see it in how other sports work.
How do you turn off that part of your brain, your critically thinking brain, when you are watching sports?
I'm not great at it.
This is one of my favorite podcasters, Jessica Luther. She's part of the team that runs the kick-ass sports and feminism podcast, Burn It All Down.
And I'm an investigative reporter and writer.
She writes a lot about the intersection of gender violence in sports.
And I am currently co-authoring a book with Kavitha Davidson called How to Love Sports When They Don't Love You Back.
Okay, total side note here, but is there not a more perfect book title for this show? Can you talk a little bit about your love of college football?
Sure. It's been a complicated journey for me over the last 5 years, but for most of my life, sort of a cliche story in that I grew up with it. And because my dad loved college football and for the single digits of my childhood, it was just he and I, and there was one TV, and we just watched a lot of football together. And I always talk about how I only applied to go to one school for college, and that was Florida State University, because I wanted Florida State football to be my college experience, which it was. We were great. It was super fun to be there when I was. But then that's exactly how I got into critiquing it. In 2013, I was transitioning out of graduate school. It was the end of that year when the high-profile case of the Florida State quarterback, Jameis Winston, it came out November 2013 that he had been reported for sexual assault about 11 months earlier. And so that's when I started writing about that particular intersection.
Florida State University quarterback Jameis Winston was accused of raping a female classmate. His DNA was found on the victim's underwear, but Jameis and his two friends claimed that the encounter was consensual. Florida State University settled with the alleged victim for $950,000. Winston went on to win the Heisman, and eventually he was the number one pick by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers in the 2015 draft.
It was actually about my alma mater and all the feelings that I had about the complicated nature of that case and about the system of college football in general.
She went from being a fan of college football to one of its critics.
I think it always starts with money. The amount of money in college football is incredible, and I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but Nick Saban, who is the head coach at Alabama,
in case you didn't know, that's the University of Alabama.
He's incredibly good at his job. But Alabama is a state where they are cutting higher ed all the time.
In fact, Alabama now ranks third in the country for the most funding cuts to higher education.
Tuitions are going up all the time, and Nick Saban is now getting paid, I don't want to give the wrong number, $11 million, something like that.
Yep, that's right. It is $11 million, and that's just for coaching one season. He's negotiated his contract to make $65 million over the course of his current deal, and that deal ends in 2025. Now, not included in that deal is the $700,000 incentives he gets per season.
It makes him the highest paid coach in the country. And more to the point, like almost in the world, there's only like a few coaches in Europe, soccer coaches, who make more money than him. And there's a race between him and Jim Harbaugh, the head coach of Michigan.
But it's not just the coaches. It's the entire system.
These guys are making tons of money, and then they have an entire staff that's also making six figures apiece, these other coaches, if not millions of dollars themselves. And then they're building gigantic stadiums. They're building gigantic athletic facilities. There's just so much money going into it. I mean, that part alone, we should all be struggling with that. These are supposed to be educational institutions, and these guys are supposed to be educators. Outside of that, then you get this sort of exploitative system where the entire point is to win games and to keep players on the field or the court or the pitch, whatever it is. You get these guys making really questionable decisions, why they don't really want to take reports of gendered violence by their players or their staffs as seriously, right? They don't want to remove a star player from the field if they can help it. That's why you get the sort of struggle around concussions. Guys don't want to report them. They don't want to lose their spot on the team. They don't want to be replaced. The coaches don't want them to if they want to keep winning. So you get this sort of exploitation that moves down the chain.
Jessica points out an important aspect of this system. While the coaches are making millions of dollars, the student athletes aren't being paid.
And all these calls for amateurism, and it's just very difficult for me to make sense of all of that and not to see that in a bad light, even though I will admit that when I start watching a college football game, I will get right back sucked in, even if my brain is thinking about all these things.
There's that argument for purity again. That argument is what the fans I talked to loved about the game, but also struggled with.
The idea is that there is some kind of purity to amateurism. So the idea that you don't pay college players to play a sport, right? And so they remain amateur. The NCAA is deeply invested in this idea of the student athlete who remains an amateur. And therefore, all of the billions of dollars that they're raking in the organization plus all of these schools never really go to the players. The argument is that the players are getting an education that they might not otherwise get, but my challenge to that every time that I hear it is that there was this wonderful study at the University of Pennsylvania a few years ago, and they looked at the racial breakdown of who actually gets educations from D1 football schools on football teams, and Black athletes are much less likely to get an education than their white counterpart, and because the system is not set up to get them an education.
This was something I heard from Annie too. Remember the lacrosse player?
But that's why you find some kids taking easy classes that go nowhere so that they can at least be eligible to play for the hope of going to the NFL, the NBA, whatever that may be. And if it doesn't work out, they have sort of a garbage degree at the end of the day.
Why do you call it a garbage degree? Just out of curiosity.
It's not a garbage degree, but people take pass-fail classes or classes that literally are like, we were sent around a list of easy classes. Classes that were like guaranteed an A that really meant nothing. You could just fulfill a degree.
So education really wasn't the priority.
So, like I always say, like I could never, ever miss a practice. I could always miss a class. I think if you were to get a kid in a more vulnerable situation who was focusing primarily on their sport and less on their degree, I can forecast them walking out of college not able to integrate into the workforce very well.
The calls for amateurism are just to keep people lining their pockets. And so we just have to be critical of all those things that were fed by these men that are in charge.
And not surprising, the guys at the top, the athletic directors, they're mostly white. And that's an important aspect to this dynamic because the players on the field are mostly young men of color who aren't getting an education.
The guys at the top, athletic directors, most coaches, even down the coaching tree. So not just the head coach, but all the assistant coaches. Vast majority of these men are white. And then for college basketball and college football, the two most profitable sports, the vast majority of players are black men. And so it's absolutely that they... I just think it's that they don't care about whether or not they get education. Certainly a fair amount of them are coming from personal backgrounds where they don't have the kind of support or history within their family to help them through school. College football, college basketball takes a lot of time. They work incredibly hard as athletes on top of the expectation that they will be students. And so I think there's probably just general struggle. And then the point of it is to keep them on the field. So they're just doing whatever that takes. So you had a scandal a few years ago with the University of North Carolina where former athletes sued because they basically got paper degrees. Like they didn't learn anything. They created fake classes so they could give them grades so they could keep them on the court and then they could graduate them. The NCAA did not care and did not punish UNC for that. They said that that's out of their purview. They don't have to take care of that. And so I just think the system in general is not really set up to get these guys through it. And then it just so happens that the two biggest sports, the vast majority of those athletes are black men.
In 2011, historian Taylor Branch wrote a piece for The Atlantic titled
"The Shame of College Sports."
In that article, he outlined when you look at the setup of modern day college sports, you get
a whiff of the plantation. It's not the same thing, and we have to be really clear about that. Obviously, this is not enslaved people. You'll hear often when people are talking about these things that quote from Branch about the whiff of the plantation, because the kind of racial and power and labor dynamic, there's a mirror between those. They reflect each other.
How do you negotiate that reality with your fandom? And how do you advise other fans to do something similar?
We all drawing lines in the sand all the time. That sport is just like any other kind of pop culture, and we're always making decisions about that. Am I gonna go see a new movie with Johnny Depp in it now that I have a way different opinion of him than I did 5 years ago? I don't know. That's the same kind of debate within myself that I'm having about whether or not I'm gonna sit down and watch college football this weekend when my dad is in town, and we like to do that together. So I think most people already have some kind of way that they manage that in their lives, especially anyone who's been marginalized in any way or has already figured out how they're going to interact with pop culture that's problematic. At the same time, we see there was a pitcher for the Chicago Cubs the year that they won the World Series a couple years ago. They brought him in right at the end of the season, and a lot of fans who've been waiting literally decades, like their whole life, to see this team that they love finally not, you know, go to the World Series and have a real chance. And at the last minute, their team brings in this guy who had reportedly committed gendered violence. And people were trying to figure out, like, what do I do now? Do I stop watching this team that I've invested so much in because the management of the team is making this bad decision? There was a woman in Chicago who set up an entire thing. Like, every time he's on the mound and he threw a pitch, you donate so much money to a local domestic violence shelter or the rape crisis center or something like that. It's kind of like, what's the carbon offset? The thing about sports teams is that they are part of the community, right? And they play a role within that community. And so when they're bringing in guys that people have trouble with, you know, one way is to give back to that community in a way that you think sort of offset the potential risk for bringing that guy in. So there's different ways to manage it, but I really just want to drive home the point that most people have already figured this out for themselves in some other capacity of how to negotiate those problematic things.
Maybe we can offset our watching of problematic men's sports by watching women's sports.
There is a kind of purity to women's sport at this point in time where you don't really run up against it. And you do feel like a lot of them are out there on the field simply because they have to love the game. Why else would they do it
right.
In these conditions?
Right.
Like, why would they put up with the shit that they have to put up with? You know, there was a lot of stuff during the National Women's Soccer League season. They didn't have like locker rooms. They didn't have places to go to the bathroom. Like, they don't even have a place to live while they're training. They're like sleeping on people's couches.
Right.
And these are like professional soccer players in the country that has easily the best women's soccer team in the world. And so when you see them play, you think, oh, they must really love this. Because like, why else do any of that? Which isn't necessarily fair to the men who obviously love it too. But there is something about that. And you don't have to reckon with the same kind of exploitation that you do in the men's game simply because the money is not there.
Right. They've got, it's pure because they have to be there for the love of the game. There's literally nothing else to love about their situation.
Thank you.
top of this episode, I mentioned that stat from an Ohio University study that found that 50% of women identified as football fans, and 57% of college women had attended 3 or more football games. I realized I hadn't asked Jessica a pivotal question. Why do young women gravitate to college football so much?
I think some of it's the community, certainly. Part of it is people's personal identity. A lot of people map themselves right onto these teams and feel very invested as part of it. You know, college football, especially like if you go to school at a college football university, there's an in-group and an out-group in that sense of you want to fit in. You want to go and you want to be part of what is a huge part of the culture of the campus so that you can feel like you're part of something.
Oh my God, I love that. Yeah. Who doesn't want to feel like they're a part of something?
Yeah. And when you're 20, yeah. College football is fun. If you're able to put aside all the things that I've talked about, the game is fun to watch. It is a lot of strategy. It's brutal. I mean, I'm not going to lie. Like, people like to watch the brutality of it and these men hit each other and get up and keep going. There are so many players on the team that you can root for. A lot of people, especially with college ball, it's not uncommon for me to get emails from fans who are conflicted and they want to know how I manage my own conflicted fandom. So that is something that I end up talking to people a fair amount about.
I really hope you enjoyed this episode and my conversation with Jessica. I would love to hear from you. Are you a fan of college football? Tweet me at PopCultPirate on Twitter, and I'm at PopCulturePirate on Instagram. This episode was produced by Annie Taylor and edited by Ricky Alvarez, Mike Sissinger, and Priscilla Mina for Refinery29. Meg Weck was our researcher. We recorded with Paul Ruest at Argo Studios in New York City. And stay tuned, because there's another episode coming up right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.